Howdy, y'all, and welcome to the Making Our Way podcast, where we take a deep dive into the projects and creative process of our fellow makers. I'm Dean DePlantis, and I'm excited to join you for this episode, along with my co-host, Christy from Twisted Twine, and Austin of High Caliber Craftsman. Hey, hey, guys. Good to see y'all again.
Hey.
Christy, I was paying attention to your Instagram, and I saw you and the girls went on a trip to Crystal Bridges Museum. Why don't you tell us about that?
Northwest Arkansas has a really nice art museum that includes a little bit of everything. It's sponsored by the Walton family with a Walmart family, and it is absolutely huge. It has outside exhibits, a Frank Lloyd Wright inspired little cabin, all type of inside pottery, sculptures, paintings, drawings, just literally everything under the sun. And usually a few months in a stretch, they'll have like a temporary exhibit. And so this time it was Crafting America is the theme. So there was a lot of specifically quilts, which of course is a big thing for me. And there was some woodworking and some pottery. And it was just, we could spend all day in one of those kind of museums because there's just so much to see, so much to learn. And one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting is I, over the years, have gone to different museums and I, you know, read about what they're making and stuff. But it was kind of nice now, like when I went this time, I kind of knew what some of this stuff was, or I could envision how it was made, or I could look at something and be like, oh, that kind of looks like walnut. And then I'd read the little tag and I'm like, oh my gosh, I was right. Or basswood or whatever, cherry or whatever it is.
So how many times when you were walking around, did you have a flash that you thought maybe you were still in your house with all of you and Marvin's stuff commingled together into this conglomerate of a lifetime of possessions?
Yeah, we are overflowing with furniture and pieces in the house. So it'll be interesting to see what makes the cut. But yeah, I mean, those type of trips are, I just really enjoy them. They're great inspiration. So Austin, did I see you working on some leather belts?
Yeah, well, just one this time. Last time I did a few for the boys, and this time I ordered myself some new leather for a belt. And I went with the Wicket and Craig again because it's so good. It's so much better than some of the other belts that were like the, you know, the import veg tan stuff. Mm-hmm. This is next tier, and it's not that much more expensive.
Nice.
So doing a YouTube video for it. It's definitely different than my normal YouTube video. It's not.
Now, are you going to actually talk in it and show your face this time?
Yeah. Okay. And I'm showing my face a little bit, talking a little bit. And normally my videos are sped up and this one is all real time, which is different. Oh. So you can hear my heavy breathing and real ASMR. So
did you go cheap and have a shtick where you pull the belt off and your pants fall down, or?
I need to do that. Yeah, that's what I need to do. The main thing I wanted was I wanted all brass hardware. So I actually used the, I ordered again from Buckle Guy like I did for the last ones and got the little bit heavier duty hardware for me, you know, to hold up the pants there. But it's came out really good. I'm wrapping up the YouTube video today. Hopefully it'll be live by the time this comes out. So a little bit different. We'll see. You never know. Every time I release a video, it's like, well, screw it. Let's see how this one goes.
Did you set the rivets with your rivet setters?
No. So they use that. That's a tubular rivet. And I wanted to be able to change the belt buckle. So if you rivet it in place, that's it. So I actually use Chicago screws. I almost went for the saddle rivets, like the hammer and then peen them over style. But last minute game change. I just use Chicago screws in case I want to change. The thing is, like, I put so much work in the belt, and then if I hate the buckle, I don't want to be like, you know, oh well, I'm stuck, or start trying to drill out rivets, you know. So I decided to stick with it. So you were working on a little piece that I'd worked on earlier. What What do you got going on?
Yeah, so Grant Alexander released his mall video, and I knew Morley had his mall video in the works, and here I am. You sent me a mall kit, and I put it in a drawer and just never did anything with it. So I had this ultimate, and it was your birthday last weekend, and you put the guilt trip on us, and then Grant sending me dirty emails, and so I was like, all right, I guess I need to make this mall finally. And so I made a leather mall with a kit that Austin sells at the High Caliber Craftsman. And so you sent, I guess it's a HDPE or what is it, Delrin? What's the head made of?
UHMW. So ultra high UHMW. Molecular plastic. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a turned plastic head, and then all the brass hardware, you know, nuts at the top and bottom, a stainless steel threaded rod, and you know, a real heavy top plate, and then washers for the bottom and the transition. So you fabricate the handle. And I think, you know, the go-to is, you know, a stacked leather handle. I know that's what you did in your video, and I know that's right. What they are on the website. And I have a laser cutter, and I have some scrap leather, but I was like, God, I'm gonna have to sit here and figure out what size circles to cut, or do I just cut them all the same and then shape them? And I'm not as good with the 3D rendering like Morley. He designed his and figured out, you know, a rough estimate on circles. You should check out his video if you want to see that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And so Grant did stacked plywood, and it came out really good. And I went, well, shit, I'm going to do that. But instead of stacked, I'm going to go vertical. I have a bunch of blanks of SpectraPly that, you know, use for turning different things. And I glued two of them together to get the size that I needed and turn the handle from this orange and white SpectraPly. Well, what ended up happening was I went to cut the ends flush, and my chop saw grabbed it and threw it across the room and broke a half inch off of it. So I went to initially just cut a half inch off the threaded rod. But what I ended up with was just a real dull, plain handle. It looked like just a chunk of wood. And I knew that didn't do service to the kit that you provided. So I did another glue up and made a little cap out of Purple Heart and Walnut, and then used that as my transition down. And then I shaped it kind of like a baseball bat kind of look. Instead of that big, you know, fat grip that's normally at the bottom of the malls, I just went with a baseball bat with a knob at the end. And I like the way it came out. It feels really good. I finished it with some Matt, who's on our podcast, Matt Voltner, has a wood preserver. I use that. And then some wax paste. I'll probably put some beeswax on it here at the end. And I did video all of it. So hopefully when I get some time, work's really started picking up. But when I get some time, we'll do a YouTube video for that.
That's cool.
The other thing was, you know, I had Memorial Day, which is when I thought I was going to do dust collection in video, but we caught the oven on fire. So Sunday, we barbecued with some friends, and we had one of those aluminum trays with a plastic lid to keep the bugs off of the barbecue. And we come inside to eat. And so I put that under the aluminum tray. Everybody fixes their plate. Well, I didn't want the dogs to have carte blanche to the barbecue. So I put the tray in the oven. Well, forgot that I put it in the oven. The next day, Memorial Day on Monday, my wife's going to cook lunch, and she hits preheat on the oven and then goes about her business. And all of a sudden, this bright white smoke starts billowing out the oven, fills every room of the house. The air conditioner return is right by the stove. So it's sucking the smoke into the air conditioner return and spewing it into every room with the door closed. So we turn that off. We open the oven. We open all the windows. And in Houston, it's hot and there's mosquitoes everywhere already. So you couldn't really open doors and whatnot. And I've got every fan blowing air out, just trying to cycle the air out. But I'm kind of curious to hear about the pottery that we're going to talk to here with Heidi, because that's what it almost was. It's that real hard plastic, not that soft plastic. So when it cooled, it was like icicles on the oven tray. So I pulled the rack out the oven, and it was just like these icicles hanging down. And to clean it, I just took a metal spatula and hit it hard, and it shattered. And that was it. I hit it four or five times, and the rack was clean. And so then I went back inside, and you could remove the screws to take the bottom out of the oven. And I brought it outside, and same thing. I just hit it with the spatula three or four times, and finally all the plastic broke off. And I just took some soap and water and cleaned it up. So cleanup wasn't bad. It was just that burning plastic smell.
Yeah. It's hard to get that out of the house.
Well, on the bright side, you got a new way to make icicles for your gingerbread house come Christmas time.
Oh yeah. I don't think I'm ever doing that again. It was a mess.
So then you ruined all your leftovers too then, right? Or it was empty.
Yeah, they were really left up. No, there was three pieces of sausage and a hamburger that had been sitting there overnight.
Oh,
you know, they'd been sitting there for 12 hours in the, or, you know, in the oven. So, c'est la vie. I didn't need that food anyway.
Hey, looks like the guest showed up.
How's it going?
Oh, hey. Today we're here with Heidi Jacobs of Whitehall Pottery. I met Heidi through the Fools with Tools podcast Facebook group, a great group of makers and a great group of folks in there. And she makes beautiful pottery. Thank you for joining us today, Heidi.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We were hoping you could start us off with a little bit about you and how you got into making, just kind of just a little bit of your backstory.
Sure. I mean, like most makers, I have been interested in making since I was a wee tot. You know, you start off with Legos and all of that jazz and hours alone. And then in college, I got into sculpture and clay work. And then my career as an artist, I was a production artist for a display company. We did a lot of work for Nike and Microsoft and all that jazz. Ooh. And then I had my son. I became a project manager and moved away from creative outlet. And my husband said, "You're miserable. You need to get back into clay." So that was kind of like a really shortened version of my maker journey. Yeah. So
that could have been real awkward if Clay was an ex-boyfriend.
Yeah. You really need to get back into Clayton.
Well, that's awesome. And you know, I'm a pottery novice. I watched a bunch of your great YouTube videos and you've got a bunch of stuff on Instagram. What is pottery? I mean, how is pottery made? If you just give us the boilerplate on pottery 101.
Sure. Well, if you aren't aware, pottery is actually wet clay that you dig out of the ground. Every region has different types of minerals and different types of clays. So in the south, you're going to get more of like a terracotta red clay. Mm-hmm. In the north, you're going to get more of like a greenish grayish clay, tan, it fires too. You, as a potter, you will manipulate the wet clay into a form that you would like to be either sculptural or functional. Some potters call themselves ceramic artists. Some people just say, "I strictly do functional work," and they are strictly a potter. I'm kind of a go between both worlds kind of gal there. So, basically, what you do is after you've created your wet masterpiece, you let it dry. You dry it really slowly so it doesn't crack. Then you put it in what's called a bisque fire. That bisque fire will take all of the moisture that was left out. All of the clay particles will start to condense into each other and it will shrink the piece. Mm. You don't fire it to full vitrification at that point because there's another step after bisque firing where you glaze it. Mm-hmm. If it's functional, you want the whole thing to be glazed. If you want it to like ruminate with tea, then you might not do the inside like Japanese style. Ooh, interesting. But for the most part, your finish point is after you have done the glaze fire, and that's over 2000 degrees.
So there's a lot to unpack there. The clay, do you go harvest this yourself or is this something you buy from a supplier? How does that work?
Well, right now I am buying from a local supplier in Carnegie, Pennsylvania, Standard Supply. I have yet to try and harvest my own clay, but we've got plenty. It's like very little topsoil, lots of clay.
Yeah. I know when they do baseballs, there's like one place in the country where they go get the clay to rub on all the baseballs. And I'm like, I wonder if there's this clay mecca where people pilgrimage to get the best clay, you know, in America.
You know, I had no idea that there was the different kinds in the different regions. We were at Crystal Bridges Museum over the weekend and Crafting America is their theme. And they had a bunch of different pottery from a bunch of different areas. So that makes a whole lot of sense as far as just the different materials that were used and the different, even though a lot of them were clay, they had a different look and a different color. So that is really interesting. I had no idea.
Yeah. I mean, you can also buy clay dry. So you can mix all of those minerals that you would find naturally in different riverbeds or, you know, ponds. And you can mix it yourself to get the different results and the different. So each clay fires at a different temperature to vitrification.
So, well, I was doing some research and I crossed like all the different kinds of clay that you use or that you can use, like the terracotta and the different color clays. Do they fire at the same temperature or is it kind of all specific to each kind of clay?
No, there's a temperature gauge called the Orton cone temperature standards. And there's like obviously a different chart for Celsius versus Fahrenheit. I'm in the States, so I refer to Fahrenheit. And when you're talking about low fire clays, so clays that schools use, clays that you might find at Michael's to like put in your kitchen oven. Those are low fire clays. They're not going to be food safe. They're mostly talc, mostly going to end up being gray or white once they're fired. But the stoneware clay that I use is a cone 6 clay, which gets up to, 2200 degrees Fahrenheit. Oh. And that's usually when it reaches its vitrification point. But there are higher fire stoneware clays that are used in wood fires and, that are higher fire porcelains as well that reach like cone 10. And cone 10, I think, is like 2,800 degrees or something close to that, which is, you know, when you talk about blacksmithing and things and you look at that molten metal, you're only at like, I don't know, 1,800 degrees.
Yeah. It's not, oh, wow. Not anywhere close. Like you can forge weld around 1,800. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is
yeah.
wild.
So when you're looking at a kiln, you can buy a low fire kiln that would do like more glass and low fire kind of things and help with annealing glass and annealing metals. But the kiln that I have reaches temperatures up to cone 10. So I have to be very careful about, you know, monitoring it, about what clays that I have in there. I have three different clay bodies that I use. One is a dark, rich chocolate colored clay body. When it fires, it looks like dark chocolate. I also have a mid-fire clay that fires tan with speckles all through it. It's manganese speckles.
Oh, yeah.
And then I also have a white clay that I typically will lean into if I need to do any kind of staining while I'm throwing. And that, I think that fires at 6 as well.
What does throwing mean?
So I was just watching the Pottery Throwdown and they were talking about where that term came from. And I can't remember it right now off the top of my head. It's terrible. Cause I was like, oh, and that's kind of weird.
So what does it mean to you?
To me, throwing is just sitting at a wheel, having the wheel head spin with your hands, pushing against centripetal force to get your vessel, the height, the width, the thinness, thickness that you want it to be in the shape.
All right. That's what Wikipedia says. Just what you said. I wanted to ask about the wheel. You know, is there a lot of variation in what a pottery wheel is, or is it kind of a wheel is a wheel?
Well, there are motorized wheels and there are human powered wheels. A kick wheel is one that you've probably seen before in a classroom where you sit on a bench, but you're using your legs to power the wheel. And oh, you wow. can't really see me right now, but I'm like demonstrating
yeah,
like with my legs where
double like decker merry-go-round.
Yeah. Yeah. So you get the wheel going and it continually spins. And then every once in a while you have to kick it again to like keep it spinning and you control your speed with your feet.
Yeah.
There's not really a brake on it. It's basically like the ones that I've seen are just a cement, really heavy cement slab that's hung from a post. And that all kind of connects together to turn the wheel head. And it has to be really heavy in order to deal with the amount of force that you're putting against the clay when you've got, you know, anywhere from 5 to 40, 50 pounds, depending on how heavy you throw. I personally have an electric wheel and it's a little 1/2 horsepower or 3/4 horsepower wheel. It's semi-professional wheel. I probably spent about $800-$900 on it when I was ready. I built my own wheel originally with a scroll saw motor.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I was wondering if like a sewing machine motor would work because it's kind of like the servo pedal driven.
Yeah. The challenge that I had with that is that the pulley system that I used that I created, it kept slipping off the belt every time that I would push down and then it would bog the motor down. So you do have to have a somewhat powerful motor in order to deal with the force against it. But it's not unachievable. I've seen more people have more success with washing machine motors or motors from ceiling fans.
Seeing where I'm from, you would use old washing machines to make fire pits or other front yard.
Well, I mean, you could use the machine itself to still make the fire pit
there
to fire your ceramics.
No, yeah.
But you could use the motor to power your wheel head.
Now, what is your setup as far as like the temperatures that you're talking about? I'm thinking, holy snaps, you got to like, where are you physically, geographically doing that in proportion to your shop or your house or that kind of thing as far as the heat?
Sure. Well, the kiln doesn't leave off a whole lot of residual heat directly around it. You want to have it several feet from any walls, and we have it against a stone wall. So it's not against anything that's going to melt or catch fire. You know, the most dangerous part of the whole thing is the electrical. the outlet on the wall, you have to check it and make sure, just like you would a washing machine outlet, you want to make sure that because of the amount of power that's going through there, it's shaking at a ridiculous amount in order to get that power to that kiln. And as the temperature is going up, it's drawing more and more and more power. And so you want to keep checking that outlet is still safe by like taking the enclosure off and just tightening those screws and everything.
Oh, wow. That's a good tip.
Yeah. I mean, you should probably do that with any major heavy machinery. Just double check your outlets every once in a while. Make sure it's not getting hot.
Austin, you check all your 220 outlets around your shop?
Yeah. Normally I just spray them with water and check for leaks.
So Heidi, we really appreciate the 101 lesson, but we definitely want to hear about some of your specific pieces. And I visited your Etsy shop this weekend and picked myself up a mug. And there's a lot of interesting designs. I was just kind of curious, you know, one, what's with Sasquatch? And yeah, what's with Sasquatch? We'll start with there.
Sure. It's more about my dad. So, you know, for a couple of years ago, for Father's Day, I made him a Sasquatch mug. And he goes, now you need to make more of these because these are going to sell. And I was like, oh, come on, Dad. Sasquatch, really? I mean, this is like 3 or 4 years ago before it was really blowing up, you know? Mm-hmm. And up here in like the state parks and things, Bigfoot's real. for a lot of people, they like get their pictures beside statues of him. He's like the Mothman of West Virginia. He's here, and people are very adamant that he's here and that he, for some is a protector and for others, he's a monster. So, you know, it's funny because my dad is like, I can't tell if he's kidding. You know, I can't tell if he's like, I really believe in this guy or if he's like just joshing everybody. But I started, you know, playing around with the idea of putting Bigfoot on different pieces. And then the pandemic hit and
yeah, those go together well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's the OG social distancer. He's, you know, like it fits so well. And every year I try and pick a meme just to have for, you know, just a talking piece for my work. And last year it was the social distancing 2020.
So I did, that's what I got. It was a Sasquatch mug. So I was wondering, maybe you've given us the 101. Could you tell me, you know, what kind of clay do you use to make those, the Sasquatch mugs, and then maybe what the glazing is or however you finish it?
Sure. So let me take a step back to how the Sasquatch is showing up on the clay itself.
Yeah,
so obviously sure. I'm throwing the vessel, and I've got a nice pristine cylinder that's ready to have either a badge put on it or a stamp put into it. And the stamps I'm illustrating, either with my tablet, I'm drawing it out, or I'm using Adobe Illustrator to create my graphic. And then I'm extruding it with Photoshop and 3D printing it.
So that was a question I have, and I have it over here. I wanted to know, how are you making these stamps? Like, how are you making these presses or these molds? So you're 3D printing them.
Yeah.
How cool.
Oh, wow.
I started out doing PLA with a Creality printer downstairs in the basement. And that was great, but I couldn't get the resolution that I wanted without having to like sand the pieces pretty heavily, because clay, it's such a lovely material because it will give you everything that you put into it, including hair, including little bits of plastic. You know, you pull the stamp out and you're like, oh, how'd that booger get in there? You know, like, where did that come? I didn't even see, I thought I had this thing super pristine clean. So I just recently moved to resin as a tool, and that's giving me a lot cleaner lines, a lot cleaner letters when I'm printing. So I'm using that right now.
And it's the same process for these stamps as the sunflowers and the hearts and the other badges that you're attaching.
Yeah. Yeah. So anything that has the badge on the front is a cookie cutter stamp with an impression. And then the ones that are deliberately pushed into the side, if you watch the Berkey mug that I made, I actually pushed the stamp into the side of the vessel itself to get that relief.
And then the handles and the badges are attached the same, like how are those attached to the vessel after you make it?
Sure. That technique's called slipping and scoring. So just like if you were trying to glue something to metal or plastic, you need to sand the surface to get, to have some tooth to it, to have the glue get into. It's the same with clay. You're taking two clay bodies, you scoring both of them to get them to adhere to each other, but you're also adding a little bit of what's called slip, which is just a really wet clay. It's slurry or slip. You're going to hear different terms used for it, and it's basically waste from throwing.
I was going to bring up particularly the custom ones you've made for like Brett and Red, and you'd mentioned Berkey and Al. I mean, those were just so spot on for each of those individuals. You did a fantastic job. So with those two, is it the similar process for those individual mugs?
Yeah. So what you're seeing me do there in those videos, so those were on Slap Stuff Together, which is my husband and I, we share a channel. Those ones, what I do normally is I interview the person that I'm going to make them for. Really quick, few questions. What's your favorite beverage? What do you drink out of? What are your favorite colors? Why do you like that vessel to drink out of? You know, what about it draws you to it? And then, you know, if I haven't had a chance to have that conversation, or I already have a vision in my head of what I think they should be drinking out of, I will do it. So like Red Smith, he is a fantastic leather worker. He's obviously a smith as well. And I just kept drawing on this idea of how do I make clay look like leather?
Exactly.
Oh my goodness. And this is on Instagram, y'all. It looks like leather. It looks like stitching and leather. And that's exactly what it looks like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm drawing on, you know, my sculptural education. Like, how do you make one thing look like something completely different? If you think about the greats that were carving out of stone. They're making flesh look like flesh out of stone. And so there are different techniques that you employ in order to get those surface textures, to get that look and feel. And I just did my research and my homework on matte glazes that I could use to make it have that like visual resonance when light hits it, to feel like it's matte, to feel like it's soft and not, you know, shiny and glossy and hard. And then there were different techniques that I did. Like I did 3D print the stamp for the logo, but then I also went in and I tooled it by hand. So it looked like leather carved, you know, that technique of
carving. Absolutely. Yeah.
And then I also made a tiny little stamp that made it look like I had stitched it. Mm-hmm. So it was like all the stitching. And then I just went along everywhere that I had stitching to give it that look. And you'll see that with, you know, any of the pieces that I made, a goblet for Brett. That goblet, throwing it wasn't so difficult. It was, coming up with the handle, 'cause I wanted it to look like it had a pewter handle.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it does too.
So I took a doily to get that like texture on the handle. So it looked like it was,
metal texture. Yeah.
It was cast in pewter. And then for his logo was super simple to 3D print. I mean, it was vector. When he sent it to me, it was all vector. So it was just really, there was no work in it for me to redraw it or anything. And you know, the hardest part of that, probably between the handle and the shape of the vessel, you know, those were pretty complicated. But what I was excited the most about, and if you watch the video of that, I was most excited about the final result, pulling that vessel out and seeing the galaxy glaze technique that I had never done before.
It looks beautiful. Mud,
It just, I was so excited, and he was live while I was opening the kiln.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm like practically in tears, 'cause I don't know if you follow a lot of ceramic artists or potters, but the success to failure ratio is pretty steep. So I was really worried that I put all this work into like making this super cool handle and getting this vessel just right, and then it was going to explode, or, you know, the glaze wasn't going to work, or something was going to happen. And I was so happy when I pulled that out, and I couldn't stop looking. I was sad to send it to him.
Well, and what it reminded me of was, I mean, it has that look of like what I would envision midnight, pitch black, out on the ocean, you know, in a pirate ship, that kind of, you know, a little bit of glistening, a little bit of color from the sky, a little bit. I mean, it was just beautiful. It was just it was perfect. It honestly really was perfect for him.
Yeah, I loved it. Austin, you had a question there.
Oh, I was going to ask you about, there was like a white paste that you rubbed on one of your videos and when you were putting one of the logos onto the... What was that you were using?
So there is a mixture that they sell. I forget what the product is, but it's a hardener for glaze, and you use it with screen print screens, and you mix some underglaze with these crystals, this like powder. You do like a 1-to-1 ratio. Mix it together. And then you just, like most people use gloves. I didn't, the gloves kept getting stuck to the screen. So you take the paste that you create, you rub it into the screen that's attached to the clay, and you get a screen print result. And I think I did that on a lot of Halloween pieces last year, which was cool because I had like ravens and skulls. And,
oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's a really fun surface technique.
Another custom piece that I saw that you did was for the Fools with Tools treasure trade for Dave Bauer. That was a fountain pen, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I'd never thrown a pen before. And I ended up trying to throw quite a few just to figure out like how to throw it, how to get the dimensions right so that I could put the nib into the pen.
Right.
And there were no videos that I could find on how to do it. There was one ceramic artist named Florian Gatsby. He had photos of what he did. And I kind of perused that a little bit. And then I also followed some jewelry artists to see how they were glazing and firing those types of, you know, those types of things to avoid, because I didn't talk about this before, but when you glaze, it turns into crystalline a glass. So it's glass melting onto the surface and fusing with your vessel while it's firing. So you can't have it on the bottom. You can't have it touching other pieces. You want to make sure that it's not dripping onto the trays, because then, you know, you're wasting like $35 for your shelf, or, you know, you don't want it dripping into your kiln. So the biggest problem with the pens was, how do I fire this and get an overall glaze finish without having them stick to my kiln and without having them to like fall over and stick to other things? And what I did there was I just put them on stilts in the kiln. So they fired straight up. And the only issue that ended up was if they were a little overweight on the top, or on like what would be the top, what would end up being the bottom of the pen, they would start to kind of fall over, and you get kind of a distorted pen, which wasn't so bad, but it wasn't what I was going for. But the one that I did for Dave had like a really bulbous grip on it, because I wanted it to kind of look like that like early mid-century kind of looking pen that you would have used under candlelight or something, just to like be hip. So, because he was doing a lot of sketching and drawing at the time,
right?
Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I gotta make him an inkwell. And then I was like, I'm not making him an inkwell. I'm making him a damn pen.
Yep. It was perfect.
Yeah. So I did a lot of research on nibs too. It's like my Google search was coming up constantly with like, do you want to buy these nibs?
Now, what is your normal, you've got an Etsy store, if I'm correct. Do you do commissions or do you do batches and sell them on your website or Etsy, or what's your sales approach?
Sure. You just like anything, you have to have multiple pronged approach, right? Right. I do commissions. They're not my favorite because obviously they're very stressful. People think, oh, well, you should be able to do this for the price that you're selling your mugs for, right? So like, I'm going to do a specialty piece for you that I've like with a technique I've never tried before, or a glaze I've never tried before, but you want to pay what you'd be paying if it was something that I was making over and over and over again. That's a difficult conversation. People come to me with things like, oh, can you make, can you make this giant bowl for me? And I'm like, sure I can, but it's going to take my whole kiln to fire it. So you're going to pay for the firing.
Right. Yeah.
And the bowl. And I'm probably going to have to make two or three of them, because there's a chance that two out of the three are going to crack or fail or whatever. Commissions, you don't make a whole lot of money on them, but there are also like, if it's an interesting enough commission that kind of pushes me to like try something new or create a product, then I might take it on. My real bread and butter really is like, selling to shops, or, specifically like coffee shops that need mugs. Yeah. And I do a lot of wholesale with them. I also have, there's a couple of gift shops that I do like Pittsburgh kind of themed pieces. And that's been really helpful. It's brought in opportunities with other people, including the UPMC. Chrissy, you and I talked a little bit about that experience. Mm-hmm. They approached Ben and I about making some pieces for them. For like a gratitude kind of dinner for the families that had lost children during the year. And, you know, that was such an empowering experience. We made these wooden blocks, Ben cut them out and sanded them and got them all nice. And then I did like a whitewash paint on them with a gold heart. And then they presented those to the families with there was information on the back telling the families what they were for. And then those blocks sat with the families at the dinners in place of their lost child. And, you know, it's just like that powerful of a message as a maker, you know, to have that type of ministry in that way, it just felt really amazing. And then when they came back to me and said, hey, so you're a potter, would you be interested in helping us come up with something that we can send to the families a month after the passing of their loved one? And, you know, I was floored. Absolutely yeah. floored. Part of me was like, run away. This is going to be heavy. Mm-hmm. But I ended up making those sunflower remembrance vessels for them. And I make probably about 15 a month for them right now.
And that was a really neat project just because you really did approach it as, you know, an industrial endeavor. I mean, you made several different variations or examples and then work through a selection process with them. And I was curious, the sunflower with the hearts instead of the seeds, you know, did you come up with that and what was kind of the message behind that?
Sure. It was a collaboration between me and the team there. They had a lot of imagery already for, you know, they have a camp, it's called Camp Wakchazi, that they set up every year for the kids, the siblings. It's a sibling bereavement camp. And they do activities with them. So like they showed me a lot of the visuals that they use for like promoting the camp. They also showed me some of the other things that they used, which kind of, they were doing like dragonflies and butterflies and the sunflower was like their main thing. And then we were talking about, you know, what if the seeds weren't seeds, what if they were hearts? And they were like, can you show us what you mean? And I did a couple of different iterations of sketches first, because I normally, when I'm doing that type of bigger work, I'll do sketch work first before I actually get on the wheel, and then kind of get an idea of what they're looking for. I did two or three different stamp variations. And one of the things that we were looking for with the stamp was that it would look almost like printmaking. Like when it was illustrated, it didn't look too realistic. It didn't look too cartoony. It looked more like something that someone carved and made a stamp. So that's kind of the brain force behind what that resulted in looking like. And I did a couple of different colors for them, but
yeah, they're beautiful pieces. So sad. A sad story, but it is a great ministry. Like you said, I'm sure it is much appreciated.
Yeah. And I've received some responses from families, that have just been, you know, I think one of the things in our culture is we like to rush through the process of grieving. Mm-hmm. We like to acknowledge it and then hide it away, right. Sanitize it. We're so quick to do that when we know that people have lost someone, especially a child, that I think it's important that we let them know they're not forgotten and their loss is not forgotten. And I think what UPMC is doing with their bereavement program is continually letting them know that they have people that care about them. And the message, I think, is resounding. Mm-hmm. And I'm so proud to be a part of that.
Yeah. No, that's an awesome project. And I appreciated the YouTube video you had on that. And then another YouTube video you had was on this Roku Fire event you went to. And I was just kind of curious, you know, what made that unique and how is that different than your normal process?
Sure. So Roku is an ancient process of firing pots. And I did not study it in college. So I don't have all of the history that the teacher at the course had. But basically, it was a solution for firing as many pots as you possibly could in a very short period of time, in order to meet a quota for, you know, the entire village, right? And the process is basically a really rapid fire technique that you have your pieces bisqued before you take them. So they're already at a state where they can be handled. They're not greenware. They're not just, you know, straight, just been sitting on a shelf for a while. They've been fired once. You take them and you put them into a higher fire situation. It's not a full vitrification process, but you fire these vessels to about 1800 degrees. And then while they're still piping hot, like orange, you take them out with tongs and put them into combustible material. When you put them into the combustible material, it'll catch fire, but you put several pieces into the combustibles, then you put a lid over the can or whatever vessel you've put the combustibles in, and it creates a vacuum and it basically sucks all the oxygen into the piece. Whatever's hottest in there is going to suck all of the atmosphere into it. And when it does that, it's pulling all that carbon and everything into the surface of the vessel and turning it pitch black, permanently pitch black. Anywhere that you've put a glaze finish or a wax or some kind of resist around that area, the black isn't going to show up, but you're going to get a chemical change that is going to create a reaction to create a different treatment or color or, you know, effect on the surface of that vessel. And so that event was a couple of weeks ago. I've done one other event like that, and it's unlike anything that I do here because I'm very controlled here. I have a plan. I know what I want. I execute it. And I'm at a point where, you know, my failure rate, I'm at like probably 90%. I'm able to execute without a fail, but, that's like throwing it into the wind and being like, do whatever you want with this thing that I've spent.
Totally unknown.
I've spent hours and hours and hours, you know, manipulating and getting it to where it's at.
And you said it was like Christmas, like,
oh God. Yeah. Every time the pieces came out, we were oohing and awing. Like it was, you know, like, oh, Santa, you outdid yourself. Yeah. But you know, the best part of that is that we all were able to take, five or six vessels that we could put into the kiln. And that meant you were at least going to get one piece that made it. And I fortunately had four pieces out of the five that came out that I was like, heck yeah, these are great.
Yeah. I heard you say that only one failed. And, you know, as we're talking, you're saying, you know, failure could be 50%. So yeah, you really came out ahead on that.
Yeah. I totally didn't expect it. The very first piece that I saw that came out was the octopus. Mm-hmm. And, or not the octopus, the elephant. I was just kind of like, yeah. Yeah, I'm done. I don't need any other pieces to make it. I'm done. This is great.
On the octopus, you put like a stencil on it. Was that something cut with like a vinyl cutter or yeah. What was... Okay, so you cut that on a stencil, put mm-hmm. that in, that was your resist? Was the... No, that would have
burned
up. That was
the glaze.
Huh?
That was the glaze resist. So
if you think about it in layers. You over that mm-hmm. and then removed it.
And then I removed it. And then so you what had was a negative. Left was... Yeah, yeah.
Ah, yeah, I see it now that I'm looking at it.
Exactly.
Well, and then some of these have like a real metallic finish to it. How did you pull that off?
Well, that glaze was called Copper Penny. Okay. And I'm not exactly sure what the glaze had in it, but it definitely came out like super shiny, very reflective, very metallic, almost like an oil spot in some ways. Like when you turn the vessel, it's got like these rainbow colors in it.
So, and I saw some of them have some texture on it. What were the tools that you were using? It looked like almost like a stirrup, like a spur, like a cowboy boot spur.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a knurling tool. It's called a Steve tool, and it's basically you can change the pattern for the knurling that you want by taking parts and pieces off and adjusting the length of the stars. And then you run it along the side of the vessel while it's turning on the wheel.
That's cool.
To kind of create that texture.
Do you have any other tools, sticks, blades, shapers that you use in your...
Everything in my kitchen.
Yeah. I was going to say that almost looked like a pasta cutter or something, the Steve Nerling tool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, when you start looking at clay and knowing that, you know, it's going to take whatever textures that you see in life, you start going to thrift stores with a different mindset. You start looking through people's kitchen drawers. What you got in there? Look at people's buttons on their clothes. Like, you look at shoe soles.
Like, I think, oh yeah, shoe. Oh, wow. Yeah, to do the prints. I think we're wrapping up, but I had a question. I've seen all these textured rolling pins. How do you use those on something you've turned and it doesn't just collapse or destroy itself?
Well, you can, but I don't.
You're not. It's a prop. I was fooled.
Well, it's not a prop. I hand build the mugs at that point. It's called slab building. It's a complete other ceramic technique where you either use a rolling pin, like a flat rolling pin, like grandma's old giant kitchen rolling pin, or use a slab roller. I'm fortunate enough to have a slab roller that I then go over top the surface with the textured pins. And then I make all different kinds of vessels. That way I can make bowls. I also have some slump molds to make plates to get that texture to kind of stay. But you can also use doilies for that same treatment.
Who would have thought doilies were so big in pottery?
Yeah. Surfboards too. Really? We would drape them and then paint through them. So you paint a color and then you fade through the doily and then pull it off and it gives you a really cool texture. And hot rod, like lowrider guys, they use it to paint cars.
Interesting.
Awesome.
That's why you don't see them anywhere. Everybody goes steals them from Nana's house and takes them out to the shop.
Yeah,
I got a bunch of them in my cedar chest.
There you go. It's the only thing y'all got worth.
That does not surprise me.
They have everything at Christie's house.
Well, Heidi, we want to thank you so much for coming on today because I learned a ton. I really didn't know much. Your YouTube videos has been the extent of my education in pottery previously. So I really appreciated our conversation this evening. Now, we will be posting some of your pictures on the Making Our Way podcast Instagram, but also where can everybody find you directly?
Sure. Well, like I said before, we have a dual channel with my husband. It's called Slap Stuff Together. It's on YouTube, Slap Stuff Together. And we have a website, Slap Stuff Together, and Instagram, Slap Stuff Together. Me personally and my pottery, you can visit my store on whitehallpottery.com. That'll take you directly to my storefront. But you can follow my entire process on Instagram. I'm not as active on YouTube. The main reason that I started a YouTube channel was because of the virtual craft shows that Carl Jacobson has been hosting with Jamie Page. And those are usually once every 2 months. We have those. If you ever are interested in wood turning, Al's Hack Shack does some really fun stuff. Franco Noce does cooking. There's some really great makers that put on an hour of their craft. And then you move on to the next person and you say hi to everybody in the chat. And then you joke and have a good time all day long. It's a really fun thing. So that's why I started the YouTube channel so that I could start teaching more and doing live lessons. And I'll sometimes post a video here and there. So you can look for things there, but Instagram is mainly the source that you're going to be able to see what I'm working on.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, Heidi, thank you so much. It was great. Thanks again.
Alrighty. Thanks for having
Very
me.
Interesting. Alrighty. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
I think that was a really good chat with Heidi, and it kind of got me thinking about things I've not done or different areas of crafting or making that I kind of am interested in. Christy, you got anything that, you know, you're kind of excited to try when you get your new big shop?
Actually CNC, which I think if any of the folks from the Mozzies group can think back to an earlier conversation, even just a few months ago, I said I would never do that because of the time involvement and at the expense and learning, blah, blah, blah. But a month or so ago, a friend of mine was getting rid of a pretty much a brand new CNC, a Shiboko XXL. And I've always helped her with her bookkeeping and stuff. And so she offered it to me for $500. So, you know, you just can't let those opportunities pass you by, you know. So, yeah, right now it's still, it's fully assembled. She put it together and used it for a project or two, but realized that she didn't have the time for the type of work that she does. So she outsources getting the pieces that she needs for it. So yeah, I've got a perfectly good ready to use CNC. So that's my, my next thing to learn to incorporate into my making.
That's cool. CNC, you know, I said this before, I thought the CNC really was a big step forward for me because it went from, you know, flats, you know, things I could cut with a saw to now I'm doing intricate work on top, or I'm adding engravings or namings and personalizations, or I'm cutting precise circles. You know, you're not at the mercy of a hole saw bit or tear out. I mean, you could really sit down and just design. I'm going to make a beer caddy and I want six circles of this diameter and this orientation. And the CNC really gives you the freedom to do stuff like that. So it'll be interesting to see what you do with that.
Yeah, and I have the Shiboko XXL, and it surprised me with how tight the tolerances were on it, that it would hold, because I was doing some press fit stuff with it on cutting out some acrylic to be a press fit inside when I made the donut lamp and stuff like that. You know, the work that I normally do, I'm working to really, you know, not like woodworker tolerances. We're doing machining tolerances, and I was really surprised. It was like within a couple thou. And just really surprised me. I think you'll have a good time with it. What about you, Dean?
So, you know, I started 3D printing 2 weeks ago with those painter's triangles. And then Vincent sent me the file for his corner finder, you know, set feet and cutting boards. And I printed that out. And then this weekend, another thing I did was I was going to work on my dust collection before we caught the house on fire. And I was going to, I printed magnetic dust connectors. So it's a 4-inch receiver to put on a tool, and it's got pockets for magnets. And then you put another one on the hose, and you could easily move one hose from tool to tool with a magnetic connector. We'll see how it works. And that's where what I want to get into is I haven't stepped into the design part yet. So I think making that and knowing that this would be really great if it was personalized to my tool, because I do feel like it's not an exact fit and that's going to be a frustration. But if I could have modified the file and printed exactly what I wanted, it would be unbelievable. So I think I've made the decision. I'm going to go ahead, bite the bullet, and start paying for and learning one of those 3D modeling programs.
Fusion. Cool. Are you going to go Fusion 360?
Yeah, I think I'm going to do Fusion 360. Cool. That seems to be what most of our friends use. And so I can get support that way. And then I've got a Skillshare account I rarely need to use more. And I know there's a bunch of Fusion courses on there. And it's technical enough, I could probably work on it at work and nobody would realize that it's not work-related. So I think that's going to be my plan.
So they hear the podcast, then you're screwed.
Well, you know, if they all want to listen to the podcast, then, you know, I'll take the listens. What about you, Austin? Anything you can think of?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's all I think about is like the next tool that I want to buy and then to learn. But so for me, I've been really thinking about a TIG welder here lately. And
oh yeah,
cause I've got the MIG, I've got the stick. I can pretty much stick anything together, but really thin stuff or just welding. There's so much spatter when you're doing like stick or MIG. I like a TIG just for the cleanliness of it and just, you know, spark control. And a lot of times I just need to stick something together good enough to do the next process to it.
Can you refresh my memory on what's the difference? I know the difference, but I don't know which is which.
Right. So MIG is typically a spool inside the welder, and then it comes out a gun. So you pull the trigger, gotcha. It arcs. Yeah.
That's what I've done just a little bit of. Okay, MIG.
Right.
Okay.
So I'm calling it stick, but really it should be called arc welding, I guess, would be the, you know, the real name. And then, but the MIG is typically your most user-friendly. That's faster to learn for sure.
What about, do you have a plasma cutter?
No, and I would love one. That's what,
man, I say all the time, if I had 10 more feet of workshop to where I could have a spark producing area and not worry about it, plasma CNC, I would rather that than a wood CNC.
So
I'd be Dean the fire ring guy if I had a plasma cutter.
If I bought the Shape Oco as like, let's get into CNC, let's learn it. And then immediately I was like, why did you just buy a wood CNC? Like, why didn't you put the money towards a plasma CNC? That it would make so much more sense for me. And I don't know. I don't even know why I did. But I mean, you know.
I feel like they're more economical. Like, I don't feel like they're that expensive.
So
compared to these wood CNC machines.
Yeah, I was looking at the, I think it's called Langmuir Pro. Uh-huh. And they're like, I think it's a 4x4 table and $4,000, somewhere around there.
And a 4x4 wood CNC would be $20,000.
Well, not.
Wait, no.
So, yeah, it depends. Like, so if you're going hobby level, like that's a hot, to me, even though they call it the pro, it, to me, that's a hobby level machine, right? It's not, doesn't have the rigidity. So it's comparable to a Shape Oco.
But why would you need rigidity? I mean, it's just a straight cut. There's no, you know, there's no resistance or friction from a tool being turned and ground into to wood. I mean, all you really need are that XY axis and then something to tell it where to go. And that's why I think they are cheaper, because they don't need to have all the other nonsense.
Yeah. I mean, you need rigidity just for anything that's moving in X, Y, and Z has to have some sort of rigidity, right? So, because if not, as it's moving, it's going to wobble and ruin your cut. So you need a little bit, but they are cheaper than I thought they would be. You know, if you start looking at like the bigger systems, like the Lincolns or the Torchmates.
Yeah, that one Jimmy DiResta has.
Yeah, they're like $25,000, I think, when I looked them up. But I don't think the money is just, you know, or maybe it's that you can cut thicker stuff or something. Maybe I'm just, you know, ignorant to it.
Yeah, I will say it looks fancy enough that they probably don't have the price on their website. But
thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a review and subscribe. If you want to reach out to us or you know a maker with a fantastic project that deserves a deep dive, send us a message on Instagram at Making Our Way Podcast. You can find all of our latest individual content on Instagram and YouTube. I'm Austin at High Caliber Craftsman. You can find Christy at Twisted Twine Woodworking. You can find Dean at Dean_Duplantis. He wears coveralls and like coveralls with nothing under them and a cowboy hat. Like he's the most red hair there is. And he's been running and working out and stuff. And there's this old lady in there, like in their 80s. And he's standing in line behind her. And she's like, turns around and looks at him. And she's like, son, if I was like 20 years younger, I'd be all over you. You're corn fed sexy.
That is hilarious. He's told his
story. That does it. You know, I've been thinking about buying coveralls and just wearing that in the shop all the time. So that way I don't have to worry about commonality of shirts. Mm-hmm. I think I'm just going to get coveralls.